Well, hello and welcome to the Theotivity Podcast. My name is Thaddeus and I'm glad that you've joined me for this episode. I'm super excited about this episode and the guest that I have with me, a longtime friend and, you know, just really has blessed my life and my family's life with the work that she's doing, none other than Deanna McLeod. And I just want you guys to get to hear a little bit of what she has to say, some of her expertise on a very important topic, which we may not be able to post this whole episode on YouTube, but we'll post the whole thing on Rumble. So make sure that you get it there if we have to cut it off here.
The Theotivity Podcast. Theotivity is the place where theology and creativity come together. Here you'll find audio narration of articles, episodes exploring the faith, culture, the arts and media, systematic theology, apologetics, guest interviews with Christian thinkers, creatives, pastors, theologians, and much more. At theotivity.com, you'll find articles and resources to help you grow in your faith, as well as a portfolio of creative works. Like, share, and subscribe to stay up to date on the latest content.
So, Deanna, how about you tell the folks who are listening a little bit about yourself, maybe about your background, some of your qualifications, and why you think that the most important thing to understand in all of this is that pineapple belongs on pizza.
Because that's exactly what you told me we should talk about is making pizza, yeah. For sure.
That's all this episode is. It's a very innocent episode.
Exactly. And that's why we're going to be highly censored. I'm 100% sure that's it.
Right, exactly. There. Yeah, those YouTube censors do not like pineapple on pizza. That's why you can't trust them.
No, exactly. Well, Thad, thanks for having me on your show. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and your audience, first of all. So my name is Deanna McLeod, and I'm the principal of a medical research firm called Kaleidoscope Strategic. And our firm specializes in doing literature reviews as in summarizing that data. And we work with the leading cancer specialists across Canada. My company has been doing reviews, systematic reviews, guidelines, and supporting doctors and doing those for almost 25 years now. So it's been a long time. We've read a lot of studies and we've published a lot of studies. So our firm's actually about to publish its 50th systematic review. And that's a peer-reviewed publication. All of them are peer-reviewed publications. And so in each one of those reviews, we'd probably have to, you know, evaluate and critically review about 25, anywhere between 5 and 25 studies in depth. And we do that with the top doctors, you know, top specialists in cancer. So that would be somebody who's done their, you know, undergrad and then, you know, gone and done medicine and then done a fellowship and then has probably done, you know, a few more years. We're looking at about people who've been in school for 10 years post-grad. So, you know, some really smart people. And so we kind of work with them and we evaluate them. So we've been trained by them. And just to kind of give some context in terms of, you know, the type of studies and the type of evaluations we do, I'm a Cochrane author. So that's like an evidence-based review. So if you're published there, that means that you kind of know what you're doing when you're looking at studies. And my first publication was in The Lancet, and that's an impact factor of 50. So just to kind of get a sense of the types of areas and places that we play in terms of clinical evaluation, that's kind of our level. And so we've generally worked in cancer research, and I've really enjoyed that because it gives a real breadth of understanding. You know, we understand basic science, you know, how certain agents and certain things turn on molecular pathways. We translate that into early preclinical science. We understand those studies all the way through to clinical research, phase three studies, and even real world data. So it's been a lot of fun because we have a very strong, you know, breadth of understanding in terms of medicine and how it works. But you asked more recently, you know, what we've been into. And so we've been doing a lot more research in the COVID related area. So we kind of did a little bit of a jump from the standard cancer over to COVID or infectious disease, specifically as it relates to some of the non-pharmaceutical interventions that were recommended, you know, in the early part of COVID. And then more recently into the clinical trial data related to the vaccine. So we've done a little bit of a shift. Honestly, infectious disease is a walk in the park compared to cancer. You know, the studies are a lot less complicated and a lot less sophisticated than what we're used to seeing. And so it's not a stretch at all to start to evaluate that data and weigh it out. So yeah, that's what we've been into more recently. And a lot of the concerns or the reason for the shift was mostly because what we found is that, you know, when you're making a recommendation or developing a guideline, what you want to make sure is that you have the evidence, the level of science, not all science is the same, that the quality of the studies is sufficient to support the claims that you're making. So if you were to say something like masks work, you know, you'd actually have to have very strong evidence to support that claim. And then you'd have to have strong evidence in the manner in which you plan on using it to support that claim. And so, for instance, the early parts of the pandemic, we were noticing that claims were being made that weren't sufficiently supported by robust enough studies, and that they were extrapolating their recommendations beyond the nature in which the studies were being done. And so that was a little bit concerning, and it was happening fairly consistently right across the board. And so then we kind of started jumping in and wanting to really get in and evaluate those studies to see if it was the data was sufficiently robust to support the claims that were being made.
Right. So glad that you guys were doing that work too. And, you know, just to point out, like, this is not like a group of, you know, let's say social media researchers who are just like looking up Instagram memes or something to research. These are serious, you know, scientists and well-qualified people on your team and people who you've been partnering with to do this research. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, great. So what are some of the principles? You know, you're not only a medical researcher, but you're also a Christian, a follower of the Lord. What are maybe some Christian approaches to thinking about medicine and this topic of, you know, healing in general? Because, you know, the Bible has something to say about that. And I just wanted to hear from you before we jump into some of the meat of, you know, dissecting some of the evidence around those topics that you mentioned already. Like, how does your faith inform the way that you approach your job as a medical researcher?
Oh, I think it's multifaceted. But I think the parts that were most compelling for me in the last 3 years were to practice the principle of do no harm, which is really to seek the wellness and well-being of your neighbor. And it's, you know, the command to love others, right? And one of the things that happens if you recommend a drug that isn't properly tested in terms of safety, isn't sufficiently tested in terms of safety, then you can't in any good conscience actually say that it's safe if it isn't safe for everybody. And so great diligence and care in ensuring that there's something that's safe and ensuring that the validity of that statement is true is the very basis for ensuring that what you're recommending and what you're standing for supporting is actually loving your neighbor. And so what I see is that truth and love go hand in hand in this particular area, because unless you take the time to ensure that they're telling the truth, then you actually aren't helping when you recommend or participate in a given endeavor, whether it's being endorsed or not. It's not the authority by which the commandment is given, you know, like in the Old Testament or in the New Testament, Caesar can give an edict and he has great authority, but it doesn't mean that it's true or it will be for the well-being of the people. And so I think as Christians, we need to basically make sure that we're very diligent in ensuring that something is true before we participate in it. And I think even more so today as multiple versions of truth emerge, and often with competing interests. And the interests are not always aligned with the well-being of others. You know, there's financial and ideological interests that and political interests that can intersect and compete with doing good and looking out for the well-being of your neighbors. So I think that one is probably something that needs to be considered by all people. And, you know, it's so funny when I engage with Christians and I start to talk in that way, they're like, well, I don't know. Like, how do I know this study? You know, I mean, if, you know, I trust the experts, what are you talking about? But right. I really think that there's a level of discernment that we all have and that common sense goes a long way. You know, like for instance, just one simple thing, like how can they recommend a vaccine, for instance, that they don't know that hasn't been studied yet, right? if you start recommending a product 4 to 5 months before it's actually produced, you need to actually test it thoroughly before you actually know that it can be true. Or if you need to test something for 10 years and it's tested for 1 year, then you could probably reason through that the testing hasn't been sufficiently conducted, that they haven't conducted sufficient safety data, safety testing.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like, and that's, you know, that's really base level common sense sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what I think happens is that there's the powers that be basically appeal to authority, and it's a low level argument. You know, they appeal to emotion and they appeal to authority. And so if you ever feel people, you know, heavily relying on, well, the expert says, or the science says, or Fauci says, or anybody says, it doesn't matter anybody, I would highly be suspicious, because it's not who it's come, who is delivering the message that should be scrutinized. It's the message itself. And, you know, and if somebody has to do an appeal to emotion, especially appeal to fear, or if there's any type of coercion involved where they're requiring or mandating something and making a basic livelihood conditional on it, then if they have to coerce, then it's probably not good in and of itself. Mm. Like, those are just basic things you can probably engage in terms of everyday logic. And I really feel that today, more than any time else, there's a lot of appeal to authority, where they're saying, you know, you don't know, you're not the expert. And I really think that we need to push back against that as Christians, because God's given us a spirit, his truth, the spirit of truth, right? Or sorry, the that's Holy so Spirit, which is his spirit, you know, which is the spirit of truth.
Yeah. And that's so in line with, like, you know, just New Testament Christianity, right? That you see even the apostles themselves, like, it wasn't just the authority that they had in themselves, even though they were inspired. It was the message that they kept on pointing back to, right? Like, Paul even encouraged and gave commendations to the Bereans, for example, for examining the scriptures, right? So there is this ethos, so to speak, in Christianity of wanting to be a people of the truth, because we follow one who is the truth, right? So these things matter as Christians, and I think it's good. It was one of the encouraging things for me in all of this, was to see how many people who are pushing back against the mainstream narrative and, you know, the whole trust in the expert sort of rhetoric that was being used, were actually a lot of Christians. I don't know if you noticed that, but, you know, maybe speak to that a little bit. Like, did you find that there were a lot of, like, within the professional medical sort of sphere and the research sort of sphere, that a lot of the people who were seeing these things and raising issues and maybe having the courage to speak out, even at risk of their jobs, that there was a faith component to that a lot of times?
Well, let me just put it this way, is that, and to my, you know, to my shame, maybe, you know, if you're in the sciences or in the medical field, you don't talk about your faith too much. It's not like you don't have it, but you might operate in alignment with it, but it's not something that's front and center in terms of the way that you talk, and, you know, the way that you exchange ideas. And so for that reason, you probably don't know, and you can't identify other Christian scientists very easily. It's interesting, because during COVID, all of a sudden, you know, I felt very strongly compelled to speak the truth, because I felt that people were being deceived, and that they were being asked to do something that could be harmful to them. And so out of compassion and love for my neighbor, I wanted to sacrifice myself and my reputation and my income and my company, because I wanted to make sure that people weren't hurt. So that was where it was coming from for me. You know, I know just how much God loves people and how much he seeks their well-being. And as his follower, I needed to do the same thing. But interestingly enough, as I stepped out there and you know, there were a few of us, I actually started to recognize that the other people who were willing to make that step too, and that we're willing to sacrifice for the well-being of the general public. And some people did have, you know, it cost a lot. We're also people of faith and people who of compassion. You know, and interestingly enough, we have a whole group of us scientists who actually pray regularly now through, you know, all the various challenges related to COVID. And so, you know, God is so good that he's also given us community, you know, in the midst of it. And I didn't have that before. I didn't have a Christian community of scientists that I could, you know, study and pray with.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
And, you know, that it's interesting, because for me, it has a little bit of a, you know, I'm primarily more of a theologian than I am. I wouldn't even pretend to be a scientist. But like, you know, that has a lot of interesting parallels for me. When you think about like the authenticity of, let's say, like the Gospels and the early Christian testimony, a lot of them, the reason why we have such high confidence with that is that it cost them so much. Like so many Christians lost their lives to give testimony to the fact that Jesus Christ rose again. Actually, that word martyr actually comes from the Greek word, which just means to be a witness. And it took on that shade of meaning to lose your life for a truthful witness later on because of Christians who were willing to sacrifice much just to bear witness to the truth. And in a way, like, you're seeing something of that. I mean, not calling you guys martyrs or anything like that. It's not to that level. But there's a certain level of credibility that you have to give when people are willing to risk a lot of loss for the sake of something they truly believe is true. Now, they could be genuinely wrong, but at least you could say, well, these people are at least genuine because they're willing to risk something for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree with you. And it was interesting, but I was reading 1 John and, you know, looking at a number of versions of it and considering the meaning of various words. And I noticed that he would interchange love and sacrifice, right? You know, love one another, yeah. Sacrifice for one another, love one another, sacrifice. I'm like, oh my gosh, the essence of love is sacrifice. It's giving yourself away for the well-being of somebody else, right? Yeah. And so I count it a privilege to be able to do that and to give what I have, and even at cost to myself and to my family, in order that people will be protected and guarded against this, and also that they would become aware and more discerning in what they allow themselves to be guided in.
So good. All right, so I'm going to shift this conversation a little bit, and this is probably a point at which I'll have to stop it on YouTube. But in the past few years, you know, it's kind of exposed a lot of things about the pharmaceutical industry to a lot of people who perhaps were in the past a little bit more ignorant towards this, including myself. And, you know, the COVID pandemic really brought many issues of transparency, accountability, credibility, you know, corruption, all those sorts of things to the forefront of a lot of lay people's minds, right? And, you know, I'd like for you to comment a little bit on that that major problem within the pharmaceutical industry, because for me, I think I had just kind of blind trust or just, you know, happy ignorance before knowing some of these things. But maybe you can point out some of the big problems in terms of regulations and maybe the lack of accountability in terms of approval of drugs and vaccines and those sorts of things. You know, what are some of those conflicts of interest at play today in big pharma, in the pharmaceutical industry? Yeah, maybe speak a little bit to that.
Yeah, I think there's a number of things that probably need to be addressed. You know, I started in the pharmaceutical arena probably about more than, let's think, oh my goodness, like 30 years ago for sure, easily, in and around that anyways. And I did my first 7 years in pharmaceutical companies. And so I did some time in the medical area there, some marketing and some sales as well. And one of the things that I learned right away that was a key fundamental part of the sales training is that you basically want to minimize in the mind of the person that you're speaking to the risk of a drug and maximize the benefits. So it's not like you're lying. You're just kind of putting an emphasis on something. And if somebody raises a concern, then you basically try and dismiss the concern as quickly as possible and then refocus on the benefits of the drug, right? You know, that is the essence of pharmaceutical sales. And then whenever I became more aware of marketing and when I participated and understood that more, there's a pre-marketing phase in a pharmaceutical when a launch. So before you actually launch your drug, before you actually have phase three trial data that would indicate that there's a benefit and a risk, the company invests a lot of money in advertising and marketing the disease before they market the drug. So with that, it's a pre-marketing strategy. So, you know, like if they're getting ready to send to, I don't know, let's just say to sell a drug that's about depression, then all of a sudden you'll have celebrities on the news. They're going to be talking about how depressed they are. You'll know, you'll have people saying depression is the worst thing ever. You'll have somebody pull up some stats and, you know, they'll say, did you know that 30% of the population is depressed and they've been depressed forever? You know, all of a sudden you'll just get all this news about depression and then you'll get, you know, maybe you know, an advocacy group, and they'll start raising money, fundraisers, because this is such a big dinner, big problem that we actually need to raise funds in order to solve this problem. But this advocacy group is all part of the pharmaceutical company. Like, they'll be funded by the pharmaceutical company. These spots will be funded by the pharmaceutical company. And it's all about the goal of raising in the mind of the consumer awareness of their need for the drug. And a lot of people probably don't recognize that this is happening. The most recent occurrence that I found of this is this, that they, that Pfizer has an RSV vaccine. And so, you know, this fall, all of a sudden, there's all these doctors on the news talking about RSV, and then like pictures of, you know, kids in the Emerge, and everybody's like, oh, my RSV is terrible. And they're, it's young children are dying and all this kind of stuff. And I know for sure the statistics on RSV, like very, very, very low mortality rate. Very few kids ever get it. You know, people get it, you know, infants will get it multiple times and recover from it. It's part of building their immune system. And so then I was like, oh, okay. So I'm going to, I went up on clinicaltrials.gov and I looked for the phase three trial results. And I'm like, oh, it's being released in a month, right? Lo and behold, a month later, oh my goodness, their phase three trial results are positive. And, you know, their vaccine is going to cure these children and blah, 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 blah. But anyways, that's a perfect example of the pre-marketing campaign that happens before the launch of a drug. And so with COVID, for instance, the pre-marketing campaign was actually part, the lockdowns and the masking were all part of that, as well as the incessant, you know, media coverage of COVID. You know, whenever they would present numbers, they would always present them in their worst possible light. So, for instance, they'd present cumulative data rather than running totals. They would, especially in the early parts, they would focus on, you know, they would focus on severe disease and fatalities when they wanted to emphasize the gravity of the disease. But then they would very quickly shift and start talking about cases when they wanted to talk about the prevalence or the spread of the disease. And so they would be doing really crafty tricks like that, where in the mind of the undiscerning consumer, all of a sudden you would say, oh, my goodness, COVID is deadly and prevalent. Everybody is susceptible to it. Whereas the really the truth of it was that only very, very few people, people who were at very high exposure and had a high risk of severe disease, were actually, you know, dying or even getting severe outcomes from COVID. But that was part of their marketing technique. And the other part was lockdowns and masking are ways of making people so uncomfortable that they become desperate for the particular product that they're about to sell. And you wouldn't be able to do that. That's unusual. I mean, the best that they ever usually do is a media spot. But one of the things that people have to understand about, well, there's two things that you probably need to understand in terms of context and COVID specifically. One is that vaccines are the most lucrative product that a company can do, because it relates back to the size of the market. And I mean, that's kind of a weird thing to think about, but the size of the market is the number of total people that you could ever possibly give your product to. So for instance, if it's late stage cancer, which is an area that I work in a lot, then it all comes down to how many people have late stage cancer. And the answer is often very few have late stage cancer. But then if you think about early stage cancer, then there's more people who have early stage cancer. If you think about something that could prevent cancer, well, then high-risk people could do it. But if you're thinking about a vaccine, then anybody who's moving and breathing, you know, any child who's born is a market. So you get 100% market. Like, everybody is in the market, right? So the vaccine market is huge. But the only thing that would make a vaccine market even better would be if you could convince people that they needed an annual vaccine. So that the seasonal vaccines, for instance, the flu vaccine, and would probably be even more lucrative than pediatric vaccines, because with pediatric vaccines, the child's born, they get their vaccine, they'll get the booster, whatever it is, and then they're done. But with respiratory vaccines, what they can do is they can basically convince you that you need it every year, so annually. And then with COVID, whenever they produce that particular vaccine, they produced it so that the part of the vaccine that they were producing would mutate a lot. So what they were hoping would happen, I'm sure, is that you might need it three or four times a year. And so they were hoping that they could deliver.
So a lot so of it's like just really, it's business driving a lot of this, just profits and so on. And,
well,
you know, it reminds me of what the Bible talks about, the love of money being the root of all kinds of evil, right? 1 Timothy 6:10. It seems like that's a lot of the incentive there.
I don't know. Like, it's hard to ascribe motive, but we can definitely say that there was a big temptation, right? That this is big, big money. This is not like just average money. Think about every person in the whole globe four times a year is big money.
More about some of the concerns around childhood vaccines. My wife and I, we've been actually reading this book. I don't know if you know it, actually. Girls All the Way Down. Vaccine science.
Oh, right. Yeah, I've heard of it.
By a bunch of different experts and vaccinologists and so on. And, you know, one of the things that they bring up is the concerns around childhood vaccines, right? And lack of actual empirical data and proper studies to support them. They say, you know, basically that I think pretty much all it seems of the vaccines do comparative studies instead of like, you know, against a control or like, you know, with no vaccination. I wanted to ask, and this is actually a question from my wife, because we're reading into this and we're just like, we're thinking about our son and, you know, about making decisions on his behalf in terms of that. Like, are there any properly done studies on childhood vaccines particularly, or you can speak to vaccines in general and how those studies are done? Because it seems like there's a lot of major conflicts of interest and even just problems with the methodology of how these studies are operated, that they tend to be comparing one vaccine to another instead of to a control, meaning, you know, a non-vaccinated child. Can you speak a little bit more to that?
Well, you're correct in saying that the only way to prove that something is better than another is to do a randomized controlled trial. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they don't do randomized controlled trials against nothing, you know, or placebo, basically means that they can't tell whether it's better than nothing. So a vaccine to a vaccine basically means, well, so whenever a pharmaceutical company designs a trial where they're comparing something to something again, it's a no lose trial. It's a false comparator, because the answer to the trial, even if one is better than the other, is always vaccine, right? Mm-hmm. So that's that's one of the things that that is very handy. And so the original, I think there was one phase 3 trial where it was compared to a placebo. And then very early on, they basically declared that the study was positive and therefore said that it was unethical to compare to a placebo again. And that type of standard, and this is something that happens, was set in the vaccine area and then followed. Now that is particularly excellent for a pharmaceutical company. And the reason why that is really, really good for a pharmaceutical company is because you have to prove safety, which means that you need to test rigorously. And when it passes all the tests, then you should be able to say, make a safety claim. It is safe. It is safe after rigorous testing. And that's what a safety claim should be supported by. But if you can basically say something to the effect that it's unethical to conduct a study more than 2 months, then you can basically say that it's safe without the rigorous testing. And if you don't conduct a phase 3 trial, you can't prove safety, but now you can declare safety, but you also can't prove harm. And so therefore, nobody who's injured by a vaccine can prove that it was a vaccine that did it because there's an absence of phase 3 trials. And so it's very much in the best interest of a pharmaceutical company to end a phase 3 trial early or to compare it to another vaccine, because then you'll never actually see if there's a safety problem or not.
Yeah, I've also noticed that they manipulate language in a way where they'll say, well, it's not been proven to cause yada, yada, yada. But what's actually meant is, well, we actually didn't test for such side effects. So therefore, we can't say if it causes such side effects. It's one of those ways where marketing, it seems, can just word things to technically not lie, but they're twisting or skewing what's being communicated. It seems to imply that, oh, this is perfectly safe. But really, what they're saying is, no, we just didn't test for any side effects. And therefore, we can say that, oh, there's no study showing that these side effects can be linked.
Mm-hmm. So I think with vaccines especially, they lean towards declarations of safety rather than safety claims, like claims where you've tested rigorously. And so what you often, and I think that there's another thing to remember is that in certain highly lucrative areas, what you do is you start to get vaccine, well, pharmaceutical companies working with the experts in that field to lower the standards. So for instance, in some areas, it would be, you know, you need 2 phase 3 trials showing a clinical endpoint, right? And the clinical endpoint should be severe outcomes and or death, right? Because that's what we're really concerned with. If we're afraid that this is killing, this infectious disease is killing somebody, then we should have the endpoint of the trial should be severe disease and or death, right? But these pharmaceutical companies basically have convinced regulators and even a lot of investigators that a surrogate endpoint is sufficient. And a surrogate endpoint is an endpoint that you can measure early on that points to a long-term benefit. But surrogate endpoints, or these are called correlates of prevention, need to be actually established. So for instance, now I don't really want to get too complicated, but immunogenicity, which is your the antibodies that you produce after you receive a vaccine, have been established as a correlate of prevention in some areas. But now more than others, they basically just say, well, if you have antibodies, that means that it works. And so the main endpoint of a lot of these trials are just the generation of antibodies. And we don't actually know whether that means that it actually prevents severe disease and death, because it's never been established as a proper correlate of prevention. And if unless it's a validated correlate of prevention, you shouldn't be using it. And yet, if you look at the vaccine trials, what you see is that they use it even though it hasn't been established. So you shouldn't be doing that, but then it's become an accepted standard, right? Another accepted standard would be that you only conduct your trials for a couple of months and then you stop them. Everybody just accepts that that's the standard. Or another accepted standard is that you compare one vaccine to another and you don't actually compare to placebo. So all of these things that should be happening in order to be able to prove safety and to prove efficacy, everybody's accepted now that they're not needed in the area of vaccines. And that's probably, and I can't say for sure, but that's probably the work of a pharmaceutical company over many, many, many years, maybe decades, is that they slowly work with the investigators and they push to have the standards eroded to the point where they're no longer able to really to claim it, but everybody just agrees that, you know, oh, it's unethical to continue. Oh, no, that is an established surrogate. Oh, I think we could use it. All of that kind of stuff.
Right. Wow. That's kind of crazy. So then are there any vaccines on the market or that have been around for a while that have like proper studies to back them up and to prove their usefulness? Can you think of any that you would say, there's really solid evidence behind this particular one?
So to be completely honest, I haven't studied all vaccines extensively. I've researched cancer extensively. I know clinical trial design extensively, and I've researched the COVID vaccines extensively. So I feel very confident in speaking to all of those, but I can speak to the fact that, you know, almost, you know, 20 years ago, I was asking the same question with my children. And I was sitting in the lobby of a pharmaceutical company that was a vaccine producer. And I was looking at their, you know, annual report. And one of the, you know, I flipped to the beginning and it's like, yes, we're in the business of saving lives. And, you know, we're so committed to everybody's well-being. And then, you know, kept flipping. And all of a sudden I got to probably about, you know, a third of the way through, and all of a sudden all the pretty pictures disappeared. And then there was just page after page of small print. And so I was flipping through those pages of small print and going, what is all this? And I'm like looking at it. And then I realized that each and every one of those little squares in the back of this small print were each lawsuits that were launched against this particular pharmaceutical company. And the vast majority of them are related to vaccine injury. And so I was shocked. I was like, whoa, why are there so many legal suits around vaccines in the back of this book? And so then I basically, stopped and thought I better take some time and research. And so one of the things that I know about pharmaceutical companies is that they have drug information departments, and you can actually call the drug information department and say, you know, send me clinical trial data on X and ask for the particular products. And so I called all of the key pharmaceutical companies related to the pediatric vaccines agents, and I asked them to send me their their phase three trials, where they compared the drug to the standard of care and followed it for 10 years with a clinical endpoint. That would be what would be required to ensure safety. And each and every one of them came back to me and said, "Sorry, we don't have that data." Then I met with my pediatrician and I said, you know, this is the exercise that I just did based on what I saw in this particular prospectus. And you're recommending that I give these vaccines to my kids. So give me the phase three trial that you're looking at that shows that it stops disease and that it's safe up to 10 years, which is what I want at least for my child. And he basically so goes, "Well, you know that those trials don't exist." And I said, "Well, how come you're recommending it to me if you're mentioning that?" And then he basically said that the Pediatric Society recommends the vaccines, and therefore he's obliged, in order to maintain his license, to recommend them to parents, even though there is no safety data.
Yeah, and that's an important point too, like, because a lot of people trust their doctors, as you know, I think. Generally speaking, they should. Like, I think doctors do want to help people out and are often getting into their medical field because of that desire to help people. So I don't want to cast shade on doctors in general. But there is something to it in the sense that, like, I know, for example, some family practices, I'm not sure if how like broad this is, but will receive pretty generous bonuses from pharmaceuticals. If they can show that, hey, all of the kids within our practice have stuck to the vaccine schedule, and there's certain incentives that play into the background and into the decision making of doctors, and even when you look at their training and so on, a lot of the training that they go through is sponsored by and like supported by the pharmaceutical industry. So you have this big conflict of interest where the ones who are recommending these drugs are, you know, either directly or indirectly being funded by the companies that make massive profits from them recommending the drugs to their patients. Is that something that you've seen, and maybe flesh that out a bit more? Like, perhaps I'm misunderstanding it, but that's on the surface to a layperson. That seems kind of the way things are right now.
Well, I think that drug companies have always been trying to encourage doctors to prescribe in a certain way. And there's, and I think, most doctors are aware of that. Some are more susceptible to it, some aren't susceptible to it. But when it comes to vaccines, one of the things that, you know, they've done, again, and this is because it's such big business, and again, because of the market size and the market potential, and especially so when it comes to respiratory vaccines, because you can do repeat injections. What they do is they capture the guideline groups. So what they'll do is, if they can get the Pediatric Association to say that doctors are required to recommend a vaccine, right? And that they can link it to the insurance that the doctor has and basically say, you know, good medical practice is that you give vaccines. And so if you don't give vaccines, then not only could you be under disciplinary review, but you could have your insurance revoked, right? Then that's a lot more cost effective than going around and trying to bribe doctors or give them incentives on an individual basis. Mm. Right? So the type of influence that we're having is at more and more so at a guideline level. So for instance, in Canada, the guideline body for immunization is called NACI. So I can't even remember what NACI stands for, but Immunization Council. But they basically are the group of doctors that recommend vaccines for Canada. And I write guidelines all the time. And one of the key things the key elements of a good guideline is that you take a question, let's just say late stage liver cancer, which is a guideline that we just did recently. And the first thing that you have to do is talk about your question. So you define your population, late stage cancer. And then you basically say, what specialists would I need to represent all spectrums of treatment for late stage cancer? And then you would go and get a panel of experts, and they would make sure to represent all treatment options. And then those experts would then sit in a room and review the data, and they would debate to the point where they've debated across specialties, to the point where they would get to a place and be able to recommend, for this group of people, we recommend this particular approach. For this group of people, we recommend this particular approach. And so this multidisciplinary view is really important in getting a robust spectrum of options on the other side. Now, one of the things that they've done is that NACI is a group that's immunization specific, right? So the only thing that they do is look at immunization. They never look at immunization with respect to, you know, natural health and what would happen if you're, helping somebody have a robust immunity versus immunization. They don't do that because they only specialize in immunization. They don't look at repurposed medications and compare it to immunization. There's no cross specialty dialogue happening when they're making those recommendations. Basically, the people at NACI just look at it and say, you know, does this trial meet our very low standards because the standards have been eroded? And if the answer is yes, they say, thumbs up, let's go, right? So that it's never a recommendation with respect to other things like it should be. It's always an immunization specific recommendation. And so the problem, there's a couple problems with that. One is that if you ask the shoemaker, if I ask a medical oncologist, you know, what should we give this patient who has cancer? He's always going to say chemotherapy because that's his answer, because that's all he knows, right? Same thing with the surgeon, is always going to say surgery. So with somebody on NACI, they're always going to recommend a vaccine because they don't know anything else. And so it would be, you know, again, coming back to common sense, it's not common sense to think that they could recommend vitamin D or repurposed drugs or anything else because all they know is vaccines. And so all that they know is once it meets this very low standard that we've set and that has been eroded over the years, then I'm going to be required to say, give it an endorsement. And so then if you can capture those people, and I'm going to talk about how you capture people, not in the sense of giving them rewards for doing it, but you capture them by giving them lucrative research contracts, right? So if I wanted to capture a high-level doctor who's in charge of writing guidelines, what I'll do is I'll give him the role of a principal investigator in a trial, which will give him $50,000 in research grants, right? And then I get to invite him to all of my research conferences where he gets to design a trial and meet other people who are doing this. And then all of a sudden he starts using the drug within the context of a clinical trial to the extent that he becomes very, very familiar with it himself. And then he'll just naturally recommend what he knows. So that is a way more effective way of capturing and influencing guidelines than, you know, what you were referring to. And I'm not saying that those ploys don't happen, but they're not as powerful or as dangerous as these other ones where you get like single specialty groups recommending something, or where you have the same people who are conducting the research trials for pharmaceutical companies making the recommendations on the use of those pharmaceuticals actually in actual clinical practice. So those types of things are even more dangerous.
Like further upstream, right? Because if you get those types of people who are then either disseminating information to the family practitioners, let's say, or whoever, or even let's say professors who are in universities who are training the doctors who will then become those practitioners, you're kind of like, you know, going to get way more bang for your buck, so to speak, from a pharmaceutical perspective, if you capture like those people upstream, who then will have all those ripple down effects to everybody else that they influence. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah. But I think that, you know, in the COVID moment, we have to realize that there's something even further upstream, which is, I think probably what COVID taught me is that there are global forces that we need to consider that are influencing the sovereignty of our healthcare system. And I'll just elaborate on that by example. Probably about 10 to 15 years ago, I think it was the first time that it happened is that, you know, our firm will be hired by companies to do literature reviews or to analyze clinical data or to make recommendations or to develop, you know, an analysis for them. And so we work quite extensively with pharmaceutical companies. So I'm not against them. And, you know, we've been hired by them and we're well respected in our field for the work that we do. But one of the things that was really interesting that was happening is I would work with somebody and then, you know, about a year later, I'd go to touch base with them. You know, 6 months later, I'd come to touch base and I'd say, hey, you know, how's it going? Or I'd go to reach out and all of a sudden they're like, oh, sorry, I'm no longer at blah, blah, blah. I've gone to global. right? And then I'd be like, global, okay, that's interesting. I wonder what that is, right? Anyway, so it happened so consistently that every time I met somebody who was particularly talented or excelled in their particular field, they'd turn around and they'd say, oh, you know, no, I'm not there anymore. I've gone to global. And so one of the things that I came to realize after some chatting is that all the pharmaceutical companies basically pull their best and their brightest, and they bring them up into a global corporation. It's almost like a global entity, and they start to make all of the policy decisions and marketing plans, and then those are then implemented across the globe, right? So you've gone from having companies where they develop strategies, marketing and sales strategies for an individual country, and now these people go and they're actually implementing things at a global level, and then they just they bake them at the global level and then they implement them locally. And so these corporations are very, very bright, and all the resources go up now. So they have incredible budgets, and they also pull the intel from different countries and then use that to develop and tweak strategies. And what that does is it puts them in a position whereby, you know, I remember my early days, we'd actually have people who specialized in negotiating contract pricing, right? So they'd go to one hospital and they'd say, okay, you use this much drug, so I'm going to give you a preferred price. And then they'd go to another one and they'd go, well, you use this much drug, so I'm going to give you less price. You know, like it was basic on market volume. And, you know, sometimes they'd pit a hospital against another hospital just to kind of get a better price and that kind of stuff. But what a lot of us don't recognize is that global corporations now can do that with countries. They can basically give or deny access to a given drug or give preferential pricing or access based on whether the country is compliant or helpful or supportive to their particular position. Wow. So that type of ability to negotiate and that supranational, not natural, national entity is very, very powerful. And one of the things that a lot of people don't know is that the standing government in 2015 basically launched what they called the biomedical sciences strategic economic tables. And these are kind of pseudo think tanks that are led by the pharmaceutical industry, and they're basically designed to tell the government how to grow the biomedical economy in Canada. And lo and behold, after a couple of years of consultation with these companies that are industry led, right? So this is industry telling our government what it should do. One of their first recommendations was that they needed to lower our regulatory food and drug regulatory standards. So we needed to lower the bar of our regulation in order to, and it says this on the government website, to attract international investment. So what that's code for is they want pharmaceutical companies to come and play in Canada. They need to now change their policy in order to attract either the money or the investment. And so one of the things that they did in the eve of 2019 is they actually passed a law that created a regulatory backdoor to our food and drug regulations, and it's called the Advanced Therapeutics Products Pathway. And what that does is it basically lowers the bar again. And, you know, we were talking about tests. So usually before to get access to Canadian markets for a drug, you'd need to prove that something is safe, effective, and that the benefits outweigh the risks. Now they can go through this backdoor, and all that they have to do is show that there's enough sufficiently supporting evidence to support the conclusion that the benefits outweigh the risks. And what's notably missing from that statement or that test is proven safety. So basically, they're creating a venue by which drugs can be let onto the market without proving safety. And the first drug that was let through the back door was, by interim order, our COVID-19 vaccines. And so they were approved and put on the market and declared safe without ever going through the rigorous testing that's required to prove safety. And one of the biggest and most problematic elements of that is that those aren't actually vaccines. What they are is gene therapy. So a gene therapy is something that modifies your you know, in very, very simply, it basically teaches your body to produce a protein or some sort of biological substance, genetic substance that's not natural to your body. So the spike protein that it's producing, that your body's being taught to produce, is foreign. And because it's a foreign protein, your body will actually attack that protein and any tissue that it's attached to as foreign, which basically makes it very, very rife for autoimmune responses. And so, you know, from what we call a mode of action, when you look at the mechanism of action, it's a problem waiting to happen. But the reason why pharmaceutical companies wanted these products approved so much and went to such great lengths to coordinate a global program is because they basically are highly adaptable, meaning that it's very easy to change them. And one of the things that they did in the food and drug regulations in 2019 and that the modifications that they're doing right now is they basically made it so that once the mRNA platform has been approved, you can put anything in there. So you can change that mRNA now and change the protein that it's expressing or the type of protein that it's expressing without ever having to go and get your drug approved again. So you can be having, wow. you can change it to who knows what. Like, for instance, this vaccine, this, I guess what they're calling is, you know, the booster for the fall, for the COVID booster. Who knows what's in it? And it won't go under any testing, zero safety testing. So, you know, the pharmaceutical companies basically were influencing now the government to now erode the safety standards that have been historically in place by law to protect Canadians. And now they've lowered that bar too. And now, mm-hmm.
So like, okay. But for me as a layperson, I'm sure a lot of the listeners now are like probably having a what the heck kind of moment. You know, and this seems like a real significant problem here. Is there any hope for like our medical industry and the pharmaceuticals and the things that we, you know, would have trusted? I think traditionally speaking, you know, it seems like there's such a level of multi-leveled actually corruptions going on in pharma and how it relates to the medical field and research and governments and all these things. There's so many things interconnected. Do you see any way forward that would be better? Like, do you see any hope for change for the better in terms of these things? Because, I mean, for me as a layperson listening, I'm like, right now, to be honest, I'm just kind of like, I'm checking out of here. Like, this is, like, I'm done with these sorts of things. Because as a layperson, I don't know what I can trust. Like, you know, how does a layperson even navigate this? How do we, you know... Okay, let me break that up into two questions. One, is there any hope that you see for positive change and reform in these really significant and worrying issues? And secondly, for a layperson, like, how do you even navigate this? Because there's so many compelling voices and experts that are trying to vie for your attention.
It's a very challenging environment, but one of the things that I would think is, you know, I think that getting to the root of the problem is always the most important thing. And so one of the things that I'm often stressing is that we need to reconsider how we're operating and where the enemy really is. You know, a lot of people are thinking about it in the traditional sense of, oh, I think my doctor got paid, you know, taken out to dinner. That must be why, you know, I'm being given this drug, or that's reason for concern. But what's really reason for concern is that there are global companies that are almost extorting countries. And there's also very powerful non-governmental organizations that are acting almost as a frontman for the pharmaceutical companies. So for instance, the Gates Foundation is an excellent example where the Gates Foundation will give, you know, it's like philanthrocapitalism. They'll basically, you know, get shares and or stakes in, you know, a given vaccine program. And then they'll turn around and take money and then they'll donate it to, you know, entities like the World Health Organization, which they control, or Gavi. And then they'll set policy that's very pro-vaccine, And that, you know, makes countries think that they need to collaborate with the World Health Organization to better coordinate pandemic preparedness and all this business. But really what it is it's basically getting these non-governmental organizations to work as you know, operatives in setting international guidelines that favor vaccines. And so I think that once we start to understand what's happening, that global pharmaceutical companies exist, that they're influencing, you know, entities like the World Health Organization, that they're they've been compromised, you know, and that our government is changing our food and drug regulations in a way that favors these corporations rather than favors Canadians. You know, we can always elect, you know, you could use our electoral vote. That, you know, when we think about public health and immunization specific guideline entities shouldn't be trusted because they're not looking at the whole picture. That you need a multitude of voices, you know, a broad number of voices in order to be able to establish whether something is right or not. And if you see censorship happening where only one group is allowed to talk, then that's, again, you know, just a reason for concern, because you could say, okay, there's probably some money involved there, right? If something is true, then it should be true even if it's debated, right? Truth shouldn't fall apart if it's debated. Debate and scientific and rigorous study should actually prove truth rather than dissolve truth, right? So, yeah, you know, that's probably a thing. But, you know, is there hope in all of this? Well, I do think that there is hope, because, you know, once we realize that things are compromised and corrupted and at a high level, then we can basically start to raise our voices, to raise awareness, and to put regulations and standards in place that shut this down, right? Like if everybody just basically said, you know what, we're not trusting this anymore until we see, you know, full transparency, until we see a multitude of voices, until you get rid of censorship, you know, all of these things, then, you know, they wouldn't be able to continue. But, you know, just on another level, that I, you know, we're going to just jump back into the theological just for a moment. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about the pre-marketing campaigns, which is basically where they need to convince you that you have a problem that they can solve, right? So that kind of plays into a little bit of a victim mentality, where we basically give up the responsibility that we have to steward our bodies well, to steward them wisely, and we release that to the authority or to the pill or to the product that is being given to us, right? And so I think, you know, as a society, we step very easily into the victim mentality, where we just want a pill to solve our problems rather than bringing them to God, and rather than taking personal responsibility to think through things and to take good care of ourselves, you know, through, you know, good eating and appropriate sleep and stress levels and all of those things, right? Things, just common sense things that we know that we should be doing. And because of that, that creates a market that then is then filled by these pharmaceutical companies. So, you know, we play a part in creating the market that then allows them to profit from us. And so I think, you know, one thing that we can consider that gives a lot of hope is to take personal responsibility for our own particular health, to do what we should be doing in terms of maintaining that health, to take the time to make discerning decisions where we don't just trust the authorities, and that we use the spirit of discernment and truth that God's given us. And through prayer and study, we discern the truth for ourselves and in our families and our communities. And I think it's because we abdicated that role of discerners and active participants that maybe the pharmaceutical companies were able to step into the gap.
Yeah, so that's so good, Deanna. Thank you for that, and some good food for thought for a lot of us. You know, I want to ask, just before we close off this episode, what's been the most difficult thing for you as a professional and as a Christian in navigating these challenges over the past few years? You know, you've been involved very heavily in this whole COVID debacle, and, you know, with advocating just for greater transparency and bringing out a lot of these things to the surface. And I think, you know, perhaps you've obviously encountered a lot of opposition You know, maybe there were things that surprised you about people's responses to the work that you were trying to genuinely do. What was one of the most difficult things for you as a professional and as a Christian to navigate?
Well, one of the difficult things is I really like people to like me.
Yeah.
You know, and I want them to think well of me. And so, you know, one of the things, you know, that pharmaceutical companies can do to hide safety in their marketing and PR campaigns is to create a taboo word, a taboo area. So like the anti-vaxxer is a perfect pejorative term that can be used to basically shut down debate and discussion. And so anytime I ever hear that term used, and it was used a lot with me, right? Then what that usually does is it points to something that the pharmaceutical company is trying to hide, which is, you know, in this case, safety data, right? They haven't done their safety testing and they actually don't have sufficient data to support safety claims in the normal sense of the word. And so having people discredit me, you know, I think I was in a legal trial and the lawyer spent the better part of a day, you know, talking about everything that was wrong with me. Why my education was insufficient and why I didn't really publish 50 trials. And I, you know, even if I did publish them in impact factor journals of 50, that I probably didn't know what I was talking about. And just, you know, there's a lot of ad hominem abusive, you know, tactics that are taken. And so I think that's really hard. And so just to continue to hold on to the position of love and forgiveness in the light of that, and to really understand that a lot of people hold that position, not because because they don't actually understand how things are being manipulated and that they've been lied to and that it's not really personal. So I think that to hold a position and a posture of compassion and forgiveness in the face of misunderstanding, I think is a huge one. And the second part is that I get afraid a lot. You know, I'm afraid because, you know, I know the size and the magnitude of the powers that are at play. And, you know, if they're willing to invoke lockdowns, which I know that killed hundreds of people, then they're really heartless, kind of ruthless people that are very powerful and have a low regard for life. And so at times standing up and continuing to speak and to defend truth and to hold a posture of love, even if it means that I'll become the focus of those people, makes me afraid, right? I get afraid. And so I just really need to rest in God's sovereign care and to trust that that obedience and love is always the better way, and that, you know, those people will not prosper in the end, that they'll fall on their own sword. And so that I just need to continue to stand and to continue to be firm and to continue to pursue the things that God has for me and the good work that he has for me to further truth and love regardless. So yeah, those would be the two greatest challenges for me.
So good. So good. And you've, I think, been exemplary in that. And I love to hear that sort of a heart behind it. Anyways, let's wrap up the episode there. Deanna, can you maybe tell people where they can find out a little bit more about the work that you're doing, perhaps point them to a helpful resource that can help them get more educated? I happen to know, you know, a particular organization called the CCCA, you know, that maybe you might want to point people towards. Yeah.
So I've been working extensively with the CCCA for the last 3 years, and a lot of the work that our firm has done in collaboration with the scientists there, there's, you know, about 600 or so of them that are active.
By the way, CCCA stands for?
Canadian COVID Care Alliance. Thanks, Dad. All right. Yeah, so I'll give you a log on. But one of the things that I'm really proud of is this pregnancy campaign that we've done recently. And that that's posted there, and I would really ask that people go and look at that. But you know, I think that the issues of vaccines, and especially particularly high risk vaccines like the COVID-19 vaccine being given to women who are pregnant and in babies that are developing, the impact of that type of inflammation can be very devastating. And the studies, the safety studies have not been done, and there are many indicators of harm at this point. So, you know, just looking into those resources and sharing them with anybody that you think is looking through, you know, is looking to consider whether that's a good choice for them at this time, You know, so breastfeeding and pregnancy, I would really highly encourage and ask for people to help send out that information. Even if people might not think that they might have bad words for you or if it's scary, you know, just to stand in love and to share those resources so that people can make informed choices.
I love that. That needs to be the heart that we do all of this in, because there has been a lot of, like, I think just anger, and some of it's, you know, justifiable, I think. But we have to be careful, especially as Christians, that we're acting out of an attitude and a spirit of Christian love and compassion for our neighbors and our fellow people. And one of the most loving things we can do is share truth. I mean, that's the whole foundation of the gospel and why we evangelize, right? Now, this is not the gospel, but it is another truth that is very important. So thankful for the work that you're doing. And thankful for you guys who are listening. Hopefully you found something edifying or thought-provoking in this episode. Until next time, Soli Deo Gloria.
Thanks for listening to the Theotivity Podcast. If you found this content helpful or edifying, please leave a review on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, follow us on social media and consider sharing this episode to help Theotivity reach others as well. Check out theotivity.com for resources, info on how to support, and subscribe to our monthly newsletter to stay up to date on all the latest content. Until next time, live and create to the glory of God.